So hello and welcome everyone. My name is Owen. I'm alongside my fellow Suds member, Richie. How are you, Richard?
Hey, Owen.
So just to point out what Suds is, we're Service Users Development Solidarity. We're an advocacy group that meets every Tuesday from 5:15 to 7:30. What we do is we campaign on issues such as social exclusion, stereotyping and stigma. We promote health and well-being. We support members to have a voice on issues that are affecting their lives. What we're doing here today is, due to Overdose Awareness Month, we would like to raise awareness for that and promote SODs so we can have our say. We'd also like to point out that while this podcast is about the figures, underneath all this, it's about people affected by overdose, such as family members, the person themselves, and the community, everyone basically. So with that being said, I'll introduce you to Dennis O'Driscoll, who are interviewing today. So Dennis, how are you?
Well, thanks.
Good to hear. So Dennis, give us a bit about yourself, your history and stuff.
I'm a pharmacist by profession. I worked in the HSE for 22 years and then left to another sector. I was chief pharmacist there, and whilst there, I took a leap of faith to try and introduce naloxone and its a greater availability for opioid overdose. And I guess that's where we all started, with recognising International Overdose Awareness Day on August 31st.
So how important is International Overdose Awareness Day?
From my perspective, I think it's really important to mark the day because of the effect that overdose has, not only on the individuals, but on their loved ones, their families, the community. It also, I think, is really important that we recognise it as an issue, and also that there's a stigma associated with that we need to remove. I think one of the more important things around it is that we also need, as you already said in the introduction, that behind each of these numbers there's actually a person, and that's the fact that we need to live with ourselves as a society, that there's an individual behind it and how that's impacted on everyone else's lives, and the grief and the loss associated with that. And I think also that we need to recognise that overdose is preventable, and there's lots of ways that we can mitigate against it or try and prevent it from happening. But I think one of the most important questions that we need to ask ourselves, Owen and Richie, from our own perspectives, is that do we all recognise the signs and symptoms of overdose? Do we all recognise the signs and symptoms of various drugs that cause overdose? And do we know what impact drug use is having on individuals and families?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, prior to me doing the naloxone training with yourself, I wouldn't have been able to recognise the symptoms of an overdose. So I'd say that would be the same for majority of people who would have a history of drug use or use drugs. So how many people are affected by overdose in Ireland?
So the stats here in Ireland are well collated. They're collected by the National Drug Related Death Index. Currently, the most up-to-date stats we have are from 2017, which in some ways doesn't reflect actually what's going on at the moment. And that's a problem. How we get over that, I'm not sure. It's something that we need to look at in the future. So, for example, one of the big issues this summer has been the novel psychoactive benzodiazepines. We've seen a little bit of drift in some of the stats around that, but we won't know exactly how they're affecting until 2 years from now. And that's the problem. We're kind of working in hindsight. And even when we started off the naloxone program, and this isn't just about opioid overdose, this is also about other drugs that may cause an overdose, such as stimulants, that it's really important that when we're looking at these programs are based on stats that you could argue are out of date. However, the important thing to remember is that from 2008 to 2017, there's been 3,700 deaths associated with poisoning or overdose in this country. In 2017, there were over 360 deaths, which was an increase on the previous year. What's interesting is to look at trends, and that's what I say to everyone when they look at this data. Don't look at the real numbers, because it's not that there's nothing wrong with looking at the real numbers, but look at the trends and what is new and coming through. So as I said, these novel psychoactives, particularly the benzo group, seem to be rising up a little bit from 20. We've only noted them from 2015, and prior to that, they weren't even noted.
Wow. I suppose, like, probably to add on to it, like, do you think we can change these figures?
I do. I think it's important that we can change these figures by a number of things. So the first thing is making everyone aware and take responsibility that people go on about, oh, it's over there, it's their problem in that area, it never happens here. It's everyone's collective responsibility, because it can be your anyone. It could be your mother, father, sister, brother. Anyone within society could be affected by an overdose. Because the thing here is that we need to consider, the most important thing is that it has no boundaries. And this is the thing that we need to remember as a society, that we need to look at how we can get the message out. And I think a very important message is through education, through people knowing what to do. So as you already said, Owen, around the whole thing, when we did the naloxone training, a lot of that was about what are the observable signs of an opioid overdose. So it was just to get people aware that how to administer a naloxone. And if you remember back to the training, I always said that naloxone wasn't like there as a treatment. It was there as an intervention to allow time for emergency services to come along.
And Dennis, what do you think are the challenges in changing these figures?
I think some of the biggest challenges is trying to ensure that we have got complete support from all sectors. So that's community, voluntary, statutory, that everyone comes together as one unit in order to drive the same message forward. That what we're trying to do here is prevent something from happening. The other thing we need to do is ensure that people have greater accessibility to services. And I know throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, that's intake into services increased substantially. And during that time, also the amount of naloxone, for example, prescribed increased substantially, which is a very positive thing.
Yeah, really is.
That's good.
So the other thing is that I think access, that if people want to use, that they have access to safe places to use drugs, that they have access to safe equipment, they have access to treatment services if that's what they want. And it comes down to the service user or the person who uses drugs desire of what they want. True. Rather than me telling you, I think this is good for you.
So why do you think there are challenges in the first place, and who do you think has a role in getting the message out there?
Okay, so to answer it and back to front, Richie, I think everyone has a role. So, but I do think that one of the challenges is breaking down the stigma and the barriers that are associated with people who use drugs.
Yes.
Breaking down those barriers is really important. And as I would always advocate, I believe that it's up to the service user, the person who uses drugs, to be the advocate for that, that all I'm here as, and other people within the Clondalkin Task Force and other voluntary and statutory agencies, we're there to support you in order to drive forward that message. And then it's how you bring people along with that message. And I think the most important thing here is that, and I think it's really well embedded within our national drug strategy, is the fact for the wider availability, for example, of naloxone to be available to communities, to individuals. What's really good with that is that recently that the use of nasal naloxone has been considered for reimbursement through our government schemes, which will mean that it should be more widely available. Brilliant. And be more easily prescribed to individuals once they start looking for naloxone, for example. But again, back to reiterate the point, and you all know this, is naloxone is only for opioids. It doesn't help with other drug overdoses. So it's very important that when we talk about overdose awareness, we are talking about opioids, but we're also talking about all the other drugs that are involved with overdose. Yeah. And I guess I should have said earlier that we also need to remember that overdose itself has been associated with polysubstance use rather than with an individual substance. So it's always a polysubstance user, and that it's been more than one substance involved in the overdose.
Yeah.
So I suppose the first part of my next question you've already answered, but do you think the government has a role in reducing these deaths? And if so, what is it?
Well, I think the government has done, and sorry, I'm going to praise the government here, much to everyone's chagrin or everyone's irritation, but it's in our national drug strategy.
Yeah.
And if you look at our national drug strategy, it wasn't in the previous one.
True.
So overdose has been put into that. Do we need an overdose strategy? I'm not sure. I do think the government has been very supportive all along with regards the provision of naloxone and the availability of naloxone. I do think that that the naloxone demonstration project, when it was launched first, did give us that kind of, leverage is the word I'll use, in order to promote it further. The more like little steps we take, the bigger the bounds we can take in the future. So the fact that I said earlier that this product could become reimbursable through the government schemes is a huge step forward for the programme, and that will make it more available for everyone. And once a nasal product is available, people, I think, will prefer that maybe to the injectable. But once the nasal is available, then we'd be looking towards other similar products within that range to be made available.
The more, the merrier.
Exactly.
Just a point, touch on one of your last points that you made in regards to substances. What substances can you overdose from?
That's a very broad question. I don't know if either of you have ever been to one of my little talks when I talk about substances, and I usually break them up into three. So you've got your depressants, your stimulants, and, as I love to call them, others. So your depressants, your classic ones, your opioids, as you all know, like morphine, heroin, methadone, your other depressants such as benzodiazepines. Mm-hmm. Keep remembering in the back of your head substances like pregabalin, i.e. Lyrica, you know, another problem substance. What was really interesting is that this year, and I guess it's more to point it out, is that novel psychoactive benzodiazepines seem to have made a reoccurrence onto the market, almost disguised as what the real product should look like.
Generic.
And the problem with that is that we don't know what the effect of that in an overdose situation is versus benzodiazepines that we know about.
Yeah.
So etazolam was the one that we saw most of, and that was seen that it was rising a little bit by little bit. And if any of you saw the street benzos on the street, they're very, very good. They're good quality product. So it's very hard for a person who wants to use these drugs to know the difference and to be aware of that. And I guess that's the whole part of where, from my perspective, SUDS or people who use drugs or anyone like that who is involved in that should be able to advocate and warn their peers around the inherent dangers of these substances coming onto the market.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing to remember is, of course, classically alcohol. People forget about it, but alcohol is so implicated in so many of our overdose statistics that we need to be aware of it. The other thing is stimulants, and we have a lovely antidote for opioids. We have less of an antidote for stimulants. So to be aware of the stimulant overdose and what that looks like. Equally, to be aware that we're seeing higher levels of quantities of stimulants being made available, for example, like the ecstasy products and some of the amphetamine products, so that there's a greater risk of overdose associated with that.
Yeah, that's true. What would be the signs and the symptoms of an overdose?
Again, it depends on depressant, stimulant. So with a depressant, Owen, you could possibly call him out, but I won't put you on the spot on this one.
I didn't really study.
So for an opioid, the classic one, if you look at observable, it's like the breathing. So
shallow
breaths. So less than 10 breaths per minute or no breathing at all. Unrousable. So the unrousable is a very important factor in that individual, that they're non-rousable. But the important thing here is that we need to remember that sometimes people who are unrousable, it may not be a drug overdose, maybe something completely different. Yeah. To remember that if you come across someone, to be aware that it may not be a drug overdose. So you need to look for other signs such as the blue tinging, particularly opiates, because people get they're not deep breathing enough, so they're getting less blood flow, so they're going, as we call it, hypoxic blue. And with a stimulant overdose, you find that people are hypothermia, meaning their temperature shoots up, but they're not sweating. And what that means is that their regulation of their temperature in their body has ceased, stopped. Because when you exercise, you sweat, that sweat cools you down. There's a whole rationale for it. When these certain stimulant drugs taken in high doses prevent that from happening, you also hear about people having sudden cardiac events associated with the use of stimulants. So there's like, they're quite distinctly different.
Yeah.
Treating-wise, we don't necessarily have a medication or that magic bullet like naloxone is. But people need to remember naloxone, as I keep saying, is not a treatment. It's there to give the time for your paramedics, for your ambulance to arrive to bring people to safety.
And that's it. Like, if you do find yourself in that situation, it's to remember, keep calm and ring emergency services. Yeah. That's the first thing to always
do.
And opiates, another sign would be the dilated of pupils, wouldn't it?
For a stimulant, you could have dilation of pupils. For an opioid, you would have pinning of your pupils.
Constricted
pupils. Yeah, correct, Richie.
And so you've explained that there, kind of, what do you do? Obviously, all I'm saying is the naloxone would be...
Yeah, so the first thing to do would be call for help. Yeah. So you find somebody, let's forget about overdose for a second. No matter in any emergency situation, somebody collapses here tonight, you'll call for help. Mm-hmm. You'll get somebody to dial 999, call an ambulance. If you have a fantastic AED on site, you'll call for the AED and start using an AED. You'll check if I'm breathing or not breathing. And depending on that scenario, if I'm breathing, you'll put me in the recovery position. You might then check for signs of drug use if I was using drugs. If, as you said, I'd used an opiate and I was slightly blue and my breathing was low, you might administer naloxone if it's available.
Yeah.
If I'm not breathing, you'll start CPR immediately after putting on the AED and then administer naloxone again if it was an opioid overdose. But equally, it could be somebody who's had a cardiac event, so you need to remember the CPR. And of course, now with COVID-19, the breaths is being considered not appropriate. So to remember that it's just chest compressions.
Yeah.
The importance, and here I go on about my little hobby horse, the importance with chest compressions to make sure to do them right.
Absolutely,
that you're pressing down enough, regularly enough, and to a beat that you're doing them fast enough to the rhythm to make sure that you're getting that compression to the correct level.
And then, as for people out there, what does AED mean?
So it's an automated external defibrillator, which is used to measure the electrical conductivity of the heart, and also then if they need to give a shock. And often shocks are provided if somebody's had a cardiovascular event. Often in opioid overdose, you may not need to use it, but the beauty of an AED is that it talks to you and tells you what to do next. And it's almost like an extra source of remembering what to do. But the other important thing is that when you've dialed that 999 or 112 call, that that person at the end of that call almost becomes your narrator to do next. Exactly, to explain what to do next.
Yeah. All right. And just moving on, so are there legal implications to staying with someone who has overdosed on drugs?
So this was a question that's always kind of asked, like, what is the roles and responsibilities here? So you all know that if somebody is called out to an emergency, the Gardaí and ambulance will arrive. The most important thing is to stay with an individual if you call an ambulance. It's so important that you stay with that individual. The guards being on site, is their primary aim is the preservation of life. So it's not that they're there to arrest people. They're there to ensure that there is a preservation of life and that everything is kept safe for those involved in the situation, members of the public, and those attending the situation. So what I would say to you is that it's really important that you stay with the person, because that person may not have had an OD, they might have just dropped because of a cardiac event. And if you don't sit by them or stay with them, they may not find them.
True.
So you should always stay with the person.
And is there a safer way to use drugs and to prevent or lower the risk of an overdose?
That's a very loaded question, Richie. Of course, I would say to use a Nancy Reagan of stop using drugs, which, is not going to float your boats. What I would say is that the most important thing with anything is to remember the times of greater risk for anyone who uses drugs. And those times, you're all aware of them. If you've lived them, you'll understand what I'm talking about. So out of a detox facility, so your tolerance has dropped, so you're not as able to take as much drugs as you previously had done. So to remember not to take as much. Caution when you're very new to treatment. There's huge stats out there to show that when you're new to treatment, that your risk of an overdose is increased because you're being new to treatment, most particularly with full opioid agonists, such as going on methadone for the first time. The other thing to keep remembering is half-lives of drugs, how long drugs last. So, for example, we all know the duration of activity of methadone is 36 plus or minus 12 hours. The duration of Valium, Anzacam, Valium, Diazepam is up to 24 hours. So to remember the half-life of drugs that if you decide to use again and how much you need to use, to be aware of those values. And the other thing is that, and back to the benzo thing and these novel psychoactive substances that are within these street benzos, the inherent dangers that I don't know what's in those, nor do you. Yeah. And therefore, to be aware of that whenever using substances that, you know, that you haven't used before, or this looks different or this looks strange, that there may be rationale for it. There could be another substance in it that we're unaware of. So it's really important to remember that the most important times is if you're going into treatment, out of treatment, have decided to detox and kind of not able to do it.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that that's a good or a bad thing. I've always been, as you all know, quite an advocate for anyone who wants to ever reduce. But the whole thing here is that if you're safe in your drug use, is obviously to reduce the use and try and get into a program and try and move away from the whole area of drug use, which is nirvana, I appreciate.
Okay, just to go back to Owen's question there, Dennis, what would be the protocol or process for someone that's addicted to the street benzos and wants to get help? What would be the process there?
Okay, so from my experience, the best thing to do is to approach your doctor, to approach a service to ask for help. Once you come into the service, there's a protocol that you have to go through in order to receive a benzodiazepine detox. It's a very complicated procedure. And why I say it's complicated is that with benzodiazepines, there's only maximum doses that are safe to prescribe in outpatient settings. So we have to be very mindful of somebody coming in saying, oh, I'm using, you know, when I was in the service, people say I'm using a fistful on a Monday, none on a Tuesday, some on a Wednesday. It was very hard to determine what exactly. And we'd always try and get people to bring their use down to a level that we could start adding in prescribing. And once prescribing starts, there has to be huge trust between the person who's getting the medication prescribed, the prescriber, and the person providing the medication, that they trust that the individual won't use other street benzos on top of what they're getting from the service or from their GP or from their pharmacy. And that they also need to be aware that the reduction is very slow and steady and has to come down quite 2 milligrams kind of every fortnight at a push, just to keep people safe, because of the risk of convulsion is the main associated risk with benzodiazepines. The other thing just to touch base on is that when I mentioned stimulants, of course I left out the big glaring hole in the room, which is cocaine and crack cocaine, and that is a stimulant and a drug that equally can cause an overdose in its own right, similar to how an amphetamine overdose can occur. And that to remember that we need availability of paraphernalia for those users, as well as we talk about injecting drug users, but we need the paraphernalia for those who like to use pipes for crack cocaine, etc., that we need to have that paraphernalia available, because we all know of the risks of paraphernalia sharing in that situation.
Yeah. Just one more question, Dennis. where would people find more information, like even if for saying a lock sound training or any information?
Good question. I would always advise that my favourite websites to go to is obviously drugs.ie. That provides a lot of information. HSE also has information on services. I would also say that if people are interested in specific areas of substance use, is the EMCDDA, which is the European, and that gives a whole list of information on country profiles if people are interested in it. But if people are just looking, like, what does this drug do? What does that drug do? Drugs.ie is a very good resource for anyone to get onto.
Brilliant. Look, Dennis, thank you very much. We really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you, Dennis.
I'd just like to remind everyone that the promotion that we're doing here is obviously to promote Save a Shoe, just developing solidarity, but fundamentally it's about saving lives, and it's about spreading the message for overdose awareness, you know, to keep everybody safe. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks, Dennis, for coming in. Thanks, Richie, for doing
thanks
this with
on.
Me. If I could just give a shout out to our Twitter handle, it's Suds Clondalkin, capital S-U-D-S, capital C, and then lowercase for the rest, and then there's a number one at the end of it. And we also have a Facebook page, which is Suds. So if you look that up, I'm sure you'll find it. And yeah, thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.